Today's episode of Cooking Issues is brought to you by Wilma Jean, delicious fried chicken and other southern comfort food classics, great burgers too. Located at 345 Smith Street in Brooklyn, Wilma Jean 345 for more information.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joined with usual Nastasia the Hammer Lopez, fresh off another trip to the Harvard.
Yeah. It was great. We like that place.
I like it a lot. I also joined, first, in engineering, who do we got? You got Jack, as usual, Inslee.
We've got a full crew back here today.
Who do you got over there?
We've got Jeet Paul, who's here, training to engineer.
What's up, training?
Wyatt Burns, who's been with us for the past few weeks.
Wyatt, yeah, I'm familiar with
Wyatt. Who, for the first time, provided you with a list of unanswered questions. Isn't that groundbreaking?
That's sweet. But, okay, listen, I don't want anyone to get ticked off here, but we have in-house Daniel Gritzer, formerly of the fantastic magazine Food & Wine, now at Serious Eats. Do you have a title over there, or just like, you know?
They're calling me culinary director.
Wow, that's fucking, that's a high title. I didn't actually drop an F-bomb. Just careful. I said, is what I got to.
Fantastic.
That's a high title there.
Yeah.
So you're running that thing? What does that mean?
No, I'm not running things. I work with, Jay Kenji Lopez.
Sure. His title is Chief Creative Officer, right?
He was. When I came on board, I think they finally decided to make things a little bit more official. So he's now Managing Culinary Director. So he and
what
I...
What does that mean? Usually managing means they handle the ad side in magazine.
No, like you can have like a managing editor.
But doesn't managing editor handle the integration of ad side into edit?
Well, yeah, okay. In print magazines, it's true. The managing editor does often straddle those lines a little bit. Here it just means there's...
You're just making up titles, aren't you? You're just making crap up.
He manages the culinary portion of the recipe portion, the cooking portion of the website.
Isn't he moving to like Botswana or something crazy? Where is he moving?
if San Francisco is Botswana, yeah.
I've never been to Botswana, so I can't say. I have been to San Francisco.
Yeah, no, he moved out to the West Coast.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I like San Francisco. San Francisco's a good town, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good place to visit the Redwoods, which are some of my favorite places in the world.
That's true.
Yeah. And, like, basically all of the Sierra Nevadas, crazy towns full of, like, crazy craziness and, like, wildfires and stuff. But really cool. I like that stuff. But that's not why we brought you here. First of all, we'll tackle tomatoes, like, midway through. You want to get what?
Well, no, you have to say what slow food means to you.
Oh, yeah, there's a cool announcement here. So at Heritage Radio and Roberta's on Friday, we're having Alice Waters and Carlo Petrini here to celebrate 25 years of slow food. It's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, it's a long time, you know, right?
Yeah, I mean, what do you think slow food's meant for food over 25 years?
I mean, look, what year was it 25 years ago?
Wow.
What's that?
Jeez.
89?
86? 85? No. We're a decade.
89?
90. Wait. 1989, right? 1989.
89, yeah.
89. The year I graduated
89,
college.
89, you're right.
89. Okay, so let's all look back to what food was like in 1989. I mean, let's look at like where the high end, where like people who cared about ingredients and stuff, where we were as a culture in 1989 versus where we are now. And I think what's interesting about it is even in the early 90s, like the concept of kind of caring about where food came from was much more advanced in Italy, where slow food was born, much more, than it was here in the U.S. at that time. But, you look at the influence of groups like Slow Foods America. Let's give a shout-out to Patrick, who is, Martin's one of the founders of that. And I think it's done a lot. It's hard to say, they were there kind of at the beginning. So I think, big player. What do you think, Daniel?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many people who can be given credit for so much that's happened in the food world in the past 25 or 30 years, from Alice Waters, who will be here. But the slow food movement, I think, if you look at the state of the food world today and the things that people talk about and even the trends that some people now get annoyed with, in terms of them being marketing lines.
Give me some annoying.
Well, you know, everything's farm to table, and then people say, okay, well, what, everything's farm to table because everything comes from, you know, that kind of
thing. Well, you know, like, we extended that, right? It's farm to toilet now.
Farm to toilet. That's going to be the new back page of the National Glossy.
Yeah, you know, remember, that's mine, farm to toilet. Like other people, I've given it to other people, but farm to toilet, that's all me. And, you know, that actually fits in with, like, the great, you know, like, American... Like American thinking about diet and like the problems with American diet and food. Like one of the early people who was interested in that was the Reverend Sylvester Graham. Like, you know, would not have actually enjoyed graham crackers, but was very interested in stopping us from masturbating and having excess sex. Uh-huh. And he thought he could do this by reducing our meat consumption to almost nil and having us eat only kind of whole, you know, whole grain breads, like cooked without like external leavenings. Kind of like really what we would consider like poorly made products. And so like, you know, he thought that this would like de-inflame our passions, get rid of like the national problem at the time, which was dyspepsia. So he, you know, his conception, this is Jacksonian America now, is that dyspepsia is one of the great problems. And it leads to things like adultery, masturbation, things like this, things that he sees as actually kind of morally reprehensible. And remember that dieting in general and detoxing and I've written about this, although I've never published it, it's all tied in with body hate and moralism about kind of what we do and what we eat and hatred of the body and of a physical self. I'm talking to you detox people. And and so, you know, that he was very much interested in pooping.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And so like the early times, it was farm to toilet. So I think over the past, you know, 25 years with this farm to table stuff, we've really been ignoring the toilet part.
Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, it is definitely the one part of the process that's generally ignored in the food conversation.
Only it's not. If you talk to someone and they go to a restaurant, how was it? It was good, but in the morning, oh. Yeah, you know what I mean? So, I mean, people actually treat the farm-to-toilet movement.
I think, though, that the toilet thing started in Italy, too. Like, they talk about pooping and how it feels and what the food – like, that's part of everyday conversation.
I agree with that, but yeah. You also don't hang out with Germans. Do Italians have the shelf in the toilet?
No.
Oh, the toilet shelf.
The toilet shelf.
Yeah.
It's for inspection.
Is that what it's for?
Hell yeah.
It was to avoid backsplash.
No, there's a famous book put out by a guy named Alan Dundas, who's now dead, who did a study of fecal expressions and fascination with toiletries in German folklore and in you know culture. It's a fascinating book, and it's called Life is Like a Chicken Coop Ladder, which you know comes from an old German expression that I won't get into here. But yeah, it's a good one.
How do they inspect it once it's on the shelf?
Well, that, you know, have you ever had like that style of toilet and you're like, who designed this freaking thing? It's like a skid machine. It's like a Skidmaster 5000. Who designed this thing? And it's because some people like to inspect the business after it's done.
Uh-huh.
It's just a terrible idea. Americans, we want the stuff to go away. There's actually another famous book. What's it called? Oh, my goodness. It came out of Cornell. I forget the author's name. Rem Koolhaas, the famous architect, along with the Graduate School of Design, recently participated in the Architectural Biennale for the and one of the things they did is they had a bunch of small books, each on a room of the house. And the one that my wife bought me, of course, was the bathroom, because I have an intense fear of public restrooms. I detest them. I especially hate – listen, anyone out there who owns a restaurant or any sort of public place – put a trash can near the door and make sure there are towels there, not just those hand dryers, because I'm going to use a towel to open the doorknob in your door, and I wish to throw that towel in a trash can because I have a mental problem that I can't touch the doorknob in a public restroom. I'll be locked in that restroom until somebody else comes in if there's not a source of paper towels nearby or if I don't happen to have a receipt in my pocket. Probably too much information.
Or toilet paper. You can use toilet paper.
Yeah, you can. But you ever, like, there have been a situation. There's just situations. I just don't like it. Just put a towels and a trash can by the door. You with me, Daniel, on this?
I'm with you. I think that they need to facilitate that for anyone who wants to use a paper towel to open the door.
Yeah.
That's a common thing.
Especially because I'm about to go cook your food. You know what I mean? Or I'm about to go – wouldn't you prefer that I didn't touch that doorknob?
Right.
Wouldn't you prefer that? Yeah, you would. Now, the – So anyway, Rem Koolhaas did this thing, and you know, along with some other people, and you know, their point is that Americans they're focusing on, but Westerners in general, like we do everything to back ass words. So we poop into water and wipe with dry things instead of pooping into a dry hole and wiping with wetness.
Oh.
And there's a fantastic book from the 70s. That was redone, I think, or maybe it's late 60s and redone in the 70s, called, you know, The Bathroom. And it's a complete ergonomic study of, like, how different cultures, like, with angles, diagrams, pictures.
One of our good friends, all of our good friends in the food industry, is using the Squatty Potty and loves it. You know what that
really?
Is?
Really?
Yeah.
Like the kind they had in Japan?
Well, because it's better for your muscles. It puts you in a squat position even when you're on a Western toilet.
Right.
First of all, who is it?
I can't.
Okay.
And his girlfriend made him throw it out because she was embarrassed by it.
Why? Who cares?
Wasn't it like hard plumbed into their?
No, it's like a stool on either side of your thingamajig.
And your legs are like up. Your knees
hey, look,
like,
it's a well known fact to anyone that's been to my family's house that I'm a believer in the wet on wet, full waste of water, because I have the Japanese toilet seats, which are, I think, the highest.
Those are the dream.
They're the apogee of toilet technology. I don't know why we've allowed ourselves to fall behind. I've discussed this on the show many times. I wish I knew who was using a squat toilet, because that's interesting information. And how do we get on? Oh, farm to toilet. Okay. So,
the contribution of Carlo Petrini and Alice Waters is.
Yeah. And Daniel, welcome to the Tangential Radio Hour, where we just go off on tangents for no apparent reason.
I just want to point out that I think that's the most Nastasia's ever chimed in.
Oh,
well, come on.
No, willingly.
Willingly.
She loves some poop talk.
I do love some poop talk.
Yeah, come on. Like, because you know why? Nastasia's in the food business, right? So she actually. I'm going to give a little secret that you're not going to be mad about. You're not going to be mad about this. I'm not like, this is nothing you wouldn't be willing to say on air.
Right.
What do you not like when you go out after work?
Oh, going out with food people who want to talk about food?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's, you know, now she gets to exercise the other subject. Poop. She doesn't care about religion or politics. So you got your poop and you got your reading.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, other less polite things, but, you know, or whatever. Okay. So here's what I figure. Like, I think we should get – now, the reason we have Daniel here today is because, as I've said many times, is that tomatoes, refrigeration, with the exception of, I think, like grape tomatoes and whatnot, which I don't really care about because I don't think it really degrades the taste of the seed section so much. But – and there's very little pulp in one of those grape tomatoes. And so, like, I've always stored those in the fridge because why the hell not? But I've always said storing tomatoes in the fridge, enemy of quality, and – Daniel came out with a series of the articles on Serious Eats, basically telling me to, not me personally, but people like me, to shove it. But it's more nuanced than that, so we're going to get into the great tomato smackdown. We got to get some reverb on that next time.
You can try it again.
The great tomato smackdown! Yeah. Tuesday. Anyway. Maybe we'll do that after the first break. You know what I'm saying? And so I feel that, like, you know, I read all your posts on it, so we'll get into a little bit now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to give you time during the 30-second commercial break to read all 6,000 words or whatever it is of tomato technology that you have. What is it, like 5,000 words?
I don't even know.
Yeah, you didn't look. You didn't even look.
I didn't even
just
count.
It just came out like a waterfall.
I know.
Yeah.
People kept asking for more.
Niagara Falls. Well, yeah, of course.
Because they kept telling me I was wrong.
Yeah. Well, look. Hey, listen. There's two things. I'll just say this as a spoiler, is that I after reading it, I, you know, like, some of the stuff is very hard to dispute. And I think people that just call people out as wrong, you need to learn this. This is the greatest thing you can learn in life, I think, is the best thing in the world that you can ever do is to be proven wrong, learn from it, and grow.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like I've learned the best things when I was wrong, you know, especially because you try to be right. You try to do as right as you can, and then when you're proven wrong, it means that you've grown. So that's a win. But I think there's room for both of us at this tomato table, because you're people. Another thing I hate about people is they read something like – you wrote a lot of words.
Yeah.
And they come back with one overarching statement that encapsulates everything. That's not the case. That's
right.
Not the – I mean, like, for instance, we have to talk about what types of tomatoes,
right.
How long,
right.
What you're doing, what your house is like, blah, blue, blee, blah, blue, blah.
Exactly. I mean, that's really the thing, is there's so many variables. And really what – I mean, I started where you were. I was a don't put the tomatoes in the refrigerator guy.
Because you're not an enemy of quality.
That's right. Yeah. I like quality.
Yeah.
I like good tomatoes. And that's what I'd always been taught. And it seemed that made sense to me, and it sort of – fit with my anecdotal experience, but I'd never tested it. So, you know, we decided, well, let's put it to the test. Let's see what actually happens. So all summer long, I was buying tomatoes of different types and different quality levels and putting half in the fridge and half on the counter and just keeping track of, and then tasting them blind and keeping track of what the results were. And it started to emerge that this thing wasn't really holding up in my tests as much as the rule to never refrigerate tomatoes suggested it should have. And I couldn't ignore that. So, yeah. So then I wrote about it, and I think there are a fair number of people simply didn't want to let go of the rule or consider the possibility that the rule may not hold as much as they think it does.
Right. People, wake up, learn, and pay attention to what people are doing, especially if they're being rigorous about it. So I've had like so many people tweet at me about your articles, and I've had people write in about it. And so, by the way, we're going to get into it in depth after the first break, but call in your questions for Daniel regarding tomatoes or anything else to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128 to talk to him live here in the Cooking Issues studios. Now, before we get into that, so where do you live?
Now I live in Queens in Jackson Heights.
Remember they bought a house?
Yeah, but where's your farmer's market? Where are you buying your tomatoes?
Oh, well, a lot of them I bought at the Jackson Heights Farmer's Market.
Yeah, I don't know any of those guys.
Which is run by Green Market. Well, it's a lot of the same.
Is Stokes there?
It's Stokes is not there, but I did get a big round of tomatoes from Stokes.
Which ones?
I got a flat of mixed heirlooms, and I got a flat of their red, they're like regular red tomatoes.
Okay, the two tomatoes from Stokes that are, to me, are the only ones that I ever, they're only tomatoes I buy other than just crap tomatoes.
Are you going to say those small yellow ones?
No, I buy the German stripes, which are large, kind of mottled yellow and red, and the Aunt Ruby's German green, which are green, relatively large, and then get a pinkish-red blush that goes around them. And I've been buying these exact two tomatoes from them for, you know, it's got to be, I don't know, like 10 years or something, like 9-10 years. Mm-hmm. So like, I wait for them every year.
Mm-hmm.
I know exactly what they look like when they're the way I want them to be and, like, how long it's going to take them to get them where I want them to be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, for me, it's like this. A lot of heirlooms, and we can get this in discussion later, aren't very good to begin with.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so we'll talk about all this, and then we'll also talk about the implications for the – remember growing up those rectangular plastic boxes of –
Oh, yeah, the clamshells of
– Yeah, the rectangular, like, mesh boxes long. They had three or four really kind of sallow-looking tomatoes, and then they were overwrapped with plastic, and then they had, like, an image of, like, a nice tomato on the plastic wrap. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Because, like, that's what I grew up with as a tomato, or, like, the diner tomato, which is that.
Right.
You know, those things are the size of, like, well, I don't know. You can't see my hands. Like a handball. They're like small, crappy, medium, small. Their size are like a little larger than a Campari tomato.
Yeah.
Which I think are a fine supermarket tomato. They taste good.
Yeah.
People hate on those things, but they taste good. And they're year-round. They're not bad to eat.
They're not all that bad.
No. Yeah. Okay. So let's get to some questions, though. And Daniel, please feel free to chime in. I have some, you know, technical cooking questions I got to get to. Otherwise, I'll hear clamorings. So Jesper writes in from Sweden regarding rotovaps and vacuums. Now, if you may recall, Jesper's written in a couple times about rotovap problems. He's building a rotovap setup. For those of you that don't know what a rotovap is, a rotary evaporator is a vacuum still that allows you to do distillation of flavors at very low temperatures and under vacuum, which means there's no oxidation and there's almost no heat damage to the flavors. Very pure flavors. And you can do it with a normal condenser. It's a piece of laboratory equipment. If you buy them used, you have to be very careful to clean them, blah, blah, blah. I use them at Booker & Dax, the bar. I have to use a very much more complicated way of doing it because I can't distill with alcohol. So in order to keep the flavors intact, I need to use liquid nitrogen and a special kind of condenser, so yada, yada. So that said, that is what a rotovap is. They ain't cheap if you – you know, they ain't cheap. I first saw one the first time when I first started working at the French Culinary, even when I was part-time there, you know, we were researching all equipment, and I knew I wanted to do some vacuum distillation, so I built a really crappy one you know, like out of parts that I found around, and it really kind of sucked, but it gave me like a taste for it. And then I saw the Rocas do a demonstration at Madrid Fusion where they did the oyster thing. It was the first time I've ever seen the distilled dirt going in, distilled dirt water that they put on oyster as their surf and turf. Mm. I was like, must get real one. Okay, so Jesper writes in, I've previously sent a question that is still unanswered. I apologize. Consequently, I would appreciate if Dave can have his expertise and opinions on this question, namely in regards to selecting a vacuum pump for a RotoVap. Though I'm already in the process of buying one. So now, Jesper's looking at, okay, so you need a vacuum to run a vacuum still. This is obvious, right?
That seems apparent, yeah.
Right, because when you lower the the pressure, when you lower the pressure inside of a system, you decrease the temperature at which things boil. Just like going up to the top of a mountain, you decrease the temperature at which things boil at a lower temperature, therefore you can shift the distillation point down to a lower temperature. That's the whole principle of what's going on here. Now the deal is you need a vacuum pump that can, one, get to a low enough vacuum pressure that you can really reduce the boiling point, especially if you're going to do cooking with it. You need very good vacuums because if you're going to try to make things like syrups and you don't want them to get too hot, they have a very high boiling point. Think of when you're boiling candy down, you're boiling down, the temperature goes up and up. You need a better and better vacuum to be able to maintain this low temperature, right? Mm-hmm. So the other thing you need is you need a vacuum that can, one, tolerate some moisture because you're going to mess up and you're going to accidentally suck some moisture up into your vacuum pump, so it needs to tolerate some moisture. And three, you need it to be powerful enough that it can suck the vacuum fast enough. So a lot of people make a mistake. They try to get either these little things called aspirators, which run off of faucets, and they're kind of weak. They're not strong enough. They can't suck enough of a vacuum fast enough to really be useful for what we're doing. And the other people go the other way. They get a really vacuum that sucks a lot, but can't get to a low enough vacuum level. So like a vacuum cleaner or a hood has a huge amount of exhaust, you know, can exhaust a huge amount, but it can't do it to a very low vacuum. So, these are the problems. So Jesper is looking at buying either the Buki V700 or V710 pump, which is their standard laboratory vacuum pump. I have the V700. It's nice. It can get down to around 10 millibars, so atmospheric pressure is about 1,065 millibar. Mm-hmm. So it gets down pretty low, but it can't really get that all the time. It can really get to about 20, especially if your RotoVap is leaking and it's kind of a pain in the ass. Leaky RotoVap, by the way, for those of you that don't know, leaky RotoVap, key cause of flavor loss in a distillation, leaky RotoVap, because your air is sucking in through the leak and stripping flavor up and out through your pump. In real life, when you're using a vacuum pump in a rotary evaporator distillation, your pump should run down to its pressure and then never turn on again. That's the best of all possible worlds, and then you're losing no flavor. Mm. Think about it. Mm-hmm. You're evacuating it down to a certain level. You're supposed to boil everything off and then recondense it in the condenser. You're not supposed to have to suck a vacuum again. It's supposed to be like closed loop. It doesn't work that way, so the pump always has to run a little bit, but it shouldn't ever run that much. The much more expensive pump, the pump I have is the one that, you know, he's saying the 700, the cheaper one. And do you know how to make this? I'm running the show for the first time off of my new iPhone 6 Plus phablet.
Oh, check that out.
But unlike my iPad, it keeps turning off on me. Do you know how to go into settings and make this thing not automatically turn off? Because I keep looking down, and then I have to use my finger to sign in.
It's only finger sign in now?
No, I still have a password on it, but like it's irritating. Every time I go to look at the question, I say something, I go down, and I see my lock screen. It's no fun. So anyways, the 710 is a much bigger pump. If you could afford it, I would go for it. If you could afford the, you know, footprint, I would go for it because it's going to be better for things like syrups because it can get down to a much lower vacuum pressure. It has another level of pump on it. There's a thing in vacuum pumps. Daniel, sorry about that. You have to listen to vacuum pump technology. But one of the problems when you're doing a vacuum is that you suck. How long is it going to stay on now?
Forever.
Really?
It says.
Woo! So there's a thing in a vacuum where if you get moisture inside of your vacuum system, right, and you're not pumping a lot, you can't get down to a low level. So they have this thing called a gas ballast that after your vacuum system lets a little bit of air in so the sucker can pump all the time, draw dry air with it, and expel out your moisture. Get it?
Yeah.
So when you're running a gas ballast to get the moisture out of your vacuum pump, the bigger vacuum pump can still reach a lower vacuum pressure, right? It's just, put it this way, it's got more balls.
Sounds good. Yeah.
All right. So if you can afford it, take it. The other question is you need a vacuum controller, and he wants to know whether he should get the V850, which is the one we have, which is basically just a standard vacuum controller. It hits a set point and stops, or the V855, which is automatic distillation. Listen, I have no idea. I would always wanted to have the 855, and if you know someone at Buki, let me tell you, it's the same freaking unit. All they got to do is like flip some switches and like do a firmware update, and they can convert. They won't. They won't do it, but it's just a software difference. It's the same piece of hardware. Isn't that just a kicker?
It sounds like Apple.
Yeah, right?
They're just crippling products.
They cripple. Why? Yeah, why? Still no USB on this damn thing. You know what I'm saying?
Caller on the line.
Oh, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave. How's it going?
Going all right. What's up?
Hey, I had a couple of equipment questions I hope you could help me with.
All right.
I'm curious, in a cheap home ice cream maker, I think I've heard you say before you like the rock salt ones.
The which one?
The rock salt?
Yep. Model. Rock salt, nice, yep.
Is there any particular model you like, or what should I look for?
All right. So I'll tell you that the sad truth is I want to love the – whatever it's called, the White Mountain, which is the kind of – the White Mountain, that's the name of it, right? I can't remember.
Yeah, I saw that on, I think, Chef Dubs like that or something.
Yeah, it's good. I have one, right? It's really good. It's expensive, right? But it's like
right.
it's oldie-timey, and the scrapers that it uses are wooden, okay? Uh-huh. Now, I had a thrift store – like I forget the name of it, like Revco or something like this. A thrift store motorized. I was stupid. I thought my kids would want to get into ice cream making with me and crank that thing. And so I bought the
Birds
hand crank
eating,
one.
Probably.
Yeah, yeah. I bought the hand crank one thinking that, oh, we would sit around the table and crank ice cream. Hell no.
Around the table exactly. By yourself.
Yeah, hell no. Yeah, I sit there by myself cranking on that thing. So, like, if I could go back, I would definitely get the motorized one because I have better things to do with my life than watch my kids watch me crank an ice cream machine. But the – so aside from that, though, like, the White Mountain is really good, but the old crappy Revco – I think Revco. I don't even remember. One that I had plastic – like scraper dashers on it that actually did, I think, a better job of getting the ice cream off the side of the freezing tin. Hmm. And so I think that – so one of the problems with rock salt and ice ice cream freezers, right, is you need to be able to effectively scrape the crystals off the side of the metal container or you get like weird like chunky crystal problems in it. And that's why those companies who make those things don't recommend that you salt the hell out of your ice. They give you a salt recommendation and they give you a freezing window that's actually a lot longer than I like. Now with my old Revco with the plastic scraper blades, until that sucker died, like I could churn out like easy like 12, 15-minute batch times on that thing and still get good scrapage on the sides. Whereas my feeling is with the scraper dasher things that they have on the White Mountain, that if you were to push the times that fast by salting the hell out of it, that it would lose its scraping efficiency. Hmm. So I've never been – but again, like, you know, I haven't played with the White Mountain as much because, you know, years ago I would make ice cream like two times a week in my old Revco one. I paid, I think, $3 for that ice cream maker on the thrift shop. I'm so sad when that thing died. And so I used to do it all the time. I also bought the really big White Mountain, so I don't know whether I would have had better results if I had used the smaller one because when I go big usually unless I'm buying something from a thrift shop. It's just, you know, it's in my nature. I can't help it. So anyway, so that's my thoughts. Am I answering any sort of question or am I just saying things? I can't tell.
No, I think that's helpful. I know what you're talking about with a scraper. My parents had an old kind of crappy one too, and I know what you're talking about with the weird chunky kind of crystal thing.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. Although I bet you could modify a White Mountain.
Yeah, that's because you retrofit.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about is I was reading a blog post from a while ago about the little tiny centrifuge.
Yep.
What do you think about that now that you've had a chance to use it more? Can it do much, and how is the yield going to compare to? Like, I love your guys' Justino techniques. I've been doing a lot of the trying, like, agar clarification. And I wonder, how's the yield going to be? Can you use it for much more than clarification? Kind of just what are your current thoughts on that machine now?
Well, it's not good for anything where you care about the solids because it's very hard. So most of the time when I work with solids in a centrifuge, you're actually dealing with kind of a stratification of layers, and you're not going to want all of those layers. And so it's useful to have large buckets so you could scrape the different layers off. So, like, let's say you're making, like, pecan, you know, you grind up pecans. You can get the oil layer, then you can get the fine nut layer, and then you can get the, like, the outer, you know, skinny layer at the bottom. And it's very hard with a machine like this. It's, first of all, it's not going to do nut separation so well, but it's very hard with a machine like this to do any real separation. So it's really only useful for things where you want the liquid on top. And you have to spin it a lot. I did do a Justino once for a large group of people, and I was back when Tristan was the bar manager at Booker and Dax, and we were in a basement in Bogota spinning for hours and hours and hours and hours.
Oh God.
And hours. But if you want to do something like lime juice, where you only need a couple ounces, and you're good. You know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did it for Hurricane Sandy too. Remember, for the Today Show, we
oh really? Oh my God, that was a nightmare. Yes. I've never been so visibly like just not in a good mood on a TV appearance ever, right? Like visibly just like making Halloween drinks in a not good mood. But anyway, it's not that big of an investment. So you know, if you want to jump in and get it, you know, I'm sure. You know, sooner or later there'll be a much better alternative, but it's not a horrible thing to play around with for things like lime juice or small amounts of grapefruit juice and things like that.
Yeah, okay, great. Thanks so much. Really appreciate the insight.
Hey, cool, no problem. Thanks for calling. Okay.
New tagline, am I answering questions or am I just saying things?
It's hard to know. I don't know. I can't tell. So anyway, back to
it's a good break time.
Wait, let me finish Jesper's question first.
Okay,
then we'll go to break. So look, the 855, the key thing with that is automatic distillation. It depends on how they run the See, for those of you that don't, when you're doing a distillation, just like when you're making candy, I tell you the boiling point goes up as you're boiling stuff off, as there's less water in the product or less alcohol, depending on what kind of distillation you're doing. Especially when you're doing alcohol distillation, which is what you're going to be doing, let's be honest, is the boiling point is constantly changing. And because the boiling point is constantly changing, you need to sit there and keep and adjust constantly the boiling point of the vacuum pressure that you're running the distillation at in order to keep a constant level of distillation. That's how you have to do it. Now, the 855 claims to have automatic distillation algorithms that make it so you can walk away from it. I've never used it. I don't know if I trust it to make the best possible flavor. Maybe it does, in which case it'll save you. I mean, like, I have to sit in front of every liter of product I want. I or someone who is trained has to sit in front of the Rotovap for an hour. Okay? So it's like if you could just – you know, Ron Popeil had said it and forget it, you know, then maybe it would be worth almost untold amounts of money if you were going to do this kind of thing a lot. One last thing you said you had, and this I'm going to get into just really quickly, Jack, before we go to the break, is you're using for your chiller. Remember, when you're doing distillation, what's the key thing you have to remember in distillation, moonshiners? Anyone?
Cutting off the tails?
Well, in terms of taste, yes. But in terms of physics, everything that you boil, you have to condense. Right? You have to, in other words, you have to have as much chilling power as you have heating power, or you'll saturate your condenser. Right? So the way moonshiners do this is they always moonshine near a creek or a well, and they just put it through a boat ton of water. Hmm. Right? Through long tubes and a lot of water, but they're not doing it at a very low temperature. In rotary evaporation, you're doing your chilling, your condensing, usually at a lower temperature, much lower than tap water. Chemists use tap water at 20 degrees Celsius because they're doing their distillations higher, like 60 degrees Celsius, and they just dump tap water through the condenser. But they're not getting a very large temperature delta between their distillation and their condensing, which means they're not getting a lot of fine resolution of flavors. They're just not doing it. They're losing a lot of stuff through their vacuum stack, okay? So you need a low temperature, but you need to have a low temperature and a lot of power. So your piece of equipment that you own, which is a Julabo FE500 recirculating cooler, only has 120 watts of cooling power at minus 10 Celsius, right? You're going to want to set it at minus 20, minus 23, start your distillation, and then that temperature is going to creep up through your distillation runs. So you're going to have to do smaller distillation runs so that your temperature doesn't get too high before you get too far in, or you're not going to be able to maintain your chilling. If I was you and if I was going to spend money on something, I would spend it on more chilling power. All right, let's go to break.
Thank you.
today's program has been brought to you by Wilma Jean, from the team behind Nightingale 9, delicious fried chicken and other Southern comfort food classics, awesome burgers too, located at 345 Smith Street in Brooklyn. That's Wilma Jean, WilmaJean345.com.
Oh, welcome back. All right, listen. Stas is like, we're only going to have time for the tomatoes. Let me, like, here, Jack, we're going to have some sort of a catch-up show at some point.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Like, because I have so many questions.
A whole
here
show dedicated to it?
To catching up. Because I have, like,
nine.
I got.
Should we put the freeze on right now? The new question freeze?
No.
What? I have a bunch of questions from Lucas. I have Sam's, like, autolyze for bread. I have cooking black bass. I have salad nichoise. I have salt and penetration. I have brine penetration. And I have salt, salting. I have eggless cooking. I have how to make a foam that doesn't break. None of these things seem that they need it right away. Liquid smoke, ISI versus SodaStream. We're gonna need to do a ketchup show.
A special ketchup show.
Special ketchup show.
How are we going to sponsor by Heinz? Yeah.
Oh, that would be sick.
That would be great.
You know, Stas, as you remember, we learned on this show, does not care about what brand of ketchup she uses.
Actually, no, that's not true. When I was away this past week.
Are you using crappy ketchup?
Someone gave like a Sir Kensington, and I was like, oh.
And you were like, where's my freaking Heinz?
Yeah.
Well, if you read Patrick's book, he's a firm believer in the Heinz being better than all their ketchup.
Yeah. You know something interesting about the Heinz Corporation? They figured out a process for making ketchup relatively early on that meant they didn't have to use sodium benzoate as a preservative in their stuff. So they were trying to push through a benzoate ban early along with some governmental people so that they could squash everybody else who still had to use benzoate. That's some sweet business. They're like, this stuff that we figured out how not to use is dangerous. But then everyone else figured it out, so it wasn't so imperative that they put the ban through.
Hey, and we're back on tomatoes.
Hey. Yeah. You know what? Look, you know, Ronald Reagan taught me as a child, ketchup, that's a straight-up veggie. It's a straight-up serving of veggie.
Sure is.
Anyone old enough to remember this? Tomato ketchup was considered, like, in school lunches. They would talk about what slow foods and that kind of thinking has done, Alice Waters and whatnot. Like, you know, back then, tomatoes were a vegetable. Think about that.
Oh, yeah. Pizza.
I mean, not tomatoes. Ketchup was a vegetable. Tomatoes are a fruit. My son's like, they're the vegetable. No, they're a fruit. But they are used as a vegetable. I mean, ketchup, vegetable, which is nuts. Okay. So, Jack, when are we going to have this ketchup show?
How about 2 weeks from now? I'm out next week, so maybe the following week. Maybe we can come in early and do a double episode.
You want to do that? Wait, yeah. But you're not here next week.
Yeah, but we'll have somebody here. Liz will be here.
We have an interesting Don Lee show next week.
We have a really interesting Don Lee. Next week, Don Lee and Paul Adams are going to come in, and we're going to eat Icelandic fermented shark on air.
No way.
The 1 week I leave.
Yeah?
Wow.
Yeah, you can come back.
I kind of want to try that.
Who do you not like at all, Jack? Because they should be running the station then.
Can't say on air.
Oh, well, we'll find out next week when we show up.
Well, we got 10 minutes, so let's...
All right, so we either do a double show next week.
No, because Jack's gone. We kind of need Jack.
For the early one? If we do a double? Well, I'll tweet out what our answer is. But we'll do a show where there's no new questions, where we just do catch up on these questions that we've missed. Not catch up. Catching up to our questions. All right, so people, I have not missed your questions. I have them. But right now, we must talk tomatoes. And that's actually one of the questions. So why don't you talk about your studies here real quick?
Okay, so it started out, let's see, over the summer, I was actually down in Florida. And I knew I wanted
Mistake.
visiting my mom. By definition, not a mistake. and I knew I wanted to get started on these.
It was the summertime. What the hell are you doing visiting Florida in the summer? Unless you're going to a mango tasting.
Mom.
You know, there's a pool.
All right.
So I didn't have access down there to really good, let's say farmers market tomatoes.
Right.
But I figured people buy a lot of tomatoes at the supermarket, so let me start this test with these. So that was the first round.
And what kind were they?
I got three kinds. I got a sort of your standard red sandwich tomato.
Yeah.
plum tomatoes,
sure.
and then some smaller, like cherry tomatoes, basically. And half in the fridge, half on the counter. I always brought the ones from the fridge back up to room temperature before tasting, just so that tasters couldn't easily identify which was which by temperature. And the first day, after the first overnight, the countertop tomatoes, the room temperature tomatoes, were clearly better than the refrigerated ones. And at that point, I was still expecting the refrigerated tomatoes to just be terrible across the board, because I was operating under the same assumption that everyone else has been. On the second day, with the so the tomatoes had sat at the counter for 2 days at that point and had been in the fridge for 2 days at that point, things flipped. And suddenly, the counter tomatoes tasted kind of dull, and whereas the refrigerated tomatoes still maintained a vibrancy, I would say.
The same level of crappiness they had before.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the bar was low here.
Yeah, the bar was low. By the way, when you said suddenly, the song Suddenly Seymour came into my head, which is an amazing song.
Suddenly Seymour.
Awesome, Daniel. I love it.
Yeah.
It's right there. It's right there with me. It's right there
Feed
with me.
Feed me, Seymour.
Oh, yeah. All right, let's continue before we get kicked off the air.
So,
not because of Suddenly Seymour, but because of our time. Yeah.
So, oh, right. Okay, so let's see. To make this quick. So that surprised me. And I started to wonder, well, okay, it looks like there's a point at which sitting out in warmer temperatures can actually be potentially more detrimental to the flavor of a tomato than a refrigerated one. But, and I wrote a thing about that, but that left a lot of questions, because these were your really generic big ag tomatoes shipped from state to state, picked green, the whole thing.
Sure, crap tanks.
Crap tanks. So how does this really apply to better tomatoes? So for the rest of this summer, I was doing tests where I was buying tomatoes pretty much at the rate that I could consume them, and refrigerating half of each kind and putting the other half on the counter. And it continued to bear out in my blind tastings, the findings. Now, my apartment is hot in the summer because I don't have air conditioning.
Mistake.
Yeah, I know. I pat myself on the back for it for environmental reasons, but it's actually really stupid. And so that's, I started to home in on this theory that a lot of the studies that had been done, the ones that I found, I haven't done an exhaustive search of all of the literature on tomato storage, but what I did find across the board, all the tomatoes that were tested in cooler temperatures. So room temperature was defined as being below 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and then compared to refrigeration temperatures. And I was finding that in my room temperature, which was well over 80 degrees Fahrenheit,
He's so angry, sweating too while he's writing.
Yeah.
Can't sleep, face against the pillow.
Oh, man. Yeah. I've done all sorts of crazy things to deal with the heat in my place, including sleeping on wet sheets. Yeah. So anyway, it continued to look like, at the very least in warm temperatures, once you have a nice ripe tomato, it actually seems to do better more often than not in the fridge than being left out to kind of wilt in the heat. A lot of people were still not happy with those results. They wanted more quantitative data, because this was mostly just qualitative. You know, I do blind tastings and say, well, I like this one because of X and that one because of Y, and sort of see where everything ended up. So then for the third round, I tried to quantify it by doing a pretty large blind tasting in my office. I had people rate the tomatoes on a scale of 0 to 10 on criteria like overall preference, texture, flavor, aroma. I had different tomatoes. I averaged them all out to see where things were. I also did many rounds of triangle tests, because one of the things that I was finding was that in many cases it was hard to actually even distinguish between the counter tomatoes and the refrigerated tomatoes.
So a triangle test, for those of you that don't know, it's two things that are the same, one thing's different, and you see if they can pick out the different one.
Right. And I did an early round of triangle tests, just sort of a test run with a colleague, and he was about 50% correct in identifying the counter tomatoes, which is better than what you'd expect
if he were guessing at random, but not great,
right.
Not great success in differentiating. And then I did a much bigger round with multiple tasters, triangle tests. It was 24 rounds, I think. And in that case, they got 9 out of the 24 rounds correct, which puts it just about in the zone of guessing at random.
Did you correct for where in the tomato they were tasting?
I tried to, you know, admit it, like my tests were not absolutely sound and scientifically perfect in how I designed them, but I did try to select cross sections that had similar representations of seed quantity and the pulpy part. So I tried not to give someone a cross section that was mostly pulp with one and mostly seed with another.
Right. I mean, one of the interesting things about tomatoes is that the flavor profile changes radically from the stem end to the tip.
Yes. Well, I was seeing much more variation within the batches, whether refrigerated or countertop, than between refrigerated and countertop.
Sure. Like when I know when I'm serving tomatoes in the summer, I'll take off the end right by the stem, taste it. If that one's flavorless, I'll take off a few more slices until I get to the flavor I like, and then I'll reserve those for another use and then put the awesome like other side up for service.
Exactly. Yeah, there's tremendous variation even within one piece of fruit. Yeah. And in fact, even in this, when I had the tasters blind tasting the big batch of tomatoes and scoring them, I had scores for every single individual piece of fruit, and I was seeing huge spreads of scores, which is partly there's a level of arbitrariness when somebody decides what's a 5 or what's a 7. You know, people tend to be somewhat consistent within their own scoring numbers, but some people just tend to score low and some tend to score high. But even with that, I could see variations were happening even within a piece of fruit that suggests exactly what you're saying, which is that you have tremendous variation within a piece of fruit, let alone I would say I saw much more variation from fruit to fruit and within a fruit than between refrigerated and countertop. And actually, the one thing I didn't mention is my last round of testing, it had actually gotten cool in New York City at that point, and so those tomatoes were sitting out in average temperatures of about 65 to 70 degrees, which I had never... My whole theory was, okay, well, if it's really warm, the refrigerator is arguably the better place to go.
Because they'll respire faster. They're still, you know, in quotes, alive, and they respire faster at higher temperatures.
Exactly. Yeah, there's just accelerated aging is happening, sure. And so you're going to have degradation. Once they've hit their sweet spot, they're just going downhill, so it's just a race to the bottom. What's amazing is that what I was finding was that even in the around 70 degrees, it was not as drastic. The countertop did better, but still I wasn't seeing this dramatic. Refrigerated tomatoes are absolutely horrible, and tomatoes stored at room temperature are great spread.
What about
this rule
105
would...
with 100% humidity in your apartment?
Oh, sweet. I love that. Well, maybe he stored some with his wet sheets. But the
had some in the shower.
So after reading...
Some on the toilet shelf.
Oh, yeah. Sweet. Sweet. Inside the toilet, the water, on the shelf for inspection. So let me just... Because after reading it, let me just give you my thoughts on reading it.
Yeah.
And then you tell me what you think about my thoughts, and then you're going to kick us off the air.
Okay.
So kind of like my initial hatred of the refrigerating tomatoes comes from, you know... like childhood days of people would buy a tomato, a crappy tomato that's underripe anyway, has very little flavor to begin with, and then they would store it in the fridge for like a week and a half,
right?
And then after a week and a half they would slice it, and it had just turned into a now it's not only is it tasteless, it's also mealy and disgusting.
Yeah.
So it's mainly this mealiness that happens after long refrigerated storage, this tissue damage that happens after long refrigerated storage to these tomatoes that. You know, that happens. You know what I mean? But so right. I think, on reading it, I'm like, look it. So over a couple of days, you're not getting that kind of a damage to a tomato by storing it in a fridge probably, right?
Exactly.
And so what the fridge is doing is the fridge is saying, stop. Stop ripening, right? So if you get it to your perfect place, then – maybe the fridge is a good place to put it as long as you let it warm thoroughly the hell up afterwards, right?
Right.
And I think for things that don't get mealy, like grape tomatoes, I store them in the fridge for – doesn't matter. I mean, they lose quality, but they're not getting mealy on me.
Right.
It's mainly mealiness that I hate. You know what I mean? And And I think some tomato varieties like are more susceptible to that.
Are
mealy.
More prone to that. Yeah, definitely. More,
and I hate that.
And the general quality level. I did see some mealiness developing. You know, for some of the tests, like the big tasting I did in my office, I knew which was which. So I was able to just do my own tastes. And I could see that for the tomatoes that I perceived to be lower quality to begin with, the mealiness was more of a problem in the refrigerator. Tasters still had a harder time differentiating when they were blind. Right. So I knew that I knew what to look for, and I could see it to some degree. So there, you know, at the end of the day, there's no argument that the refrigerator is a great place to put tomatoes.
By the way, also, in case anyone wonders if they haven't read the stuff yet, he was storing them right on the counter, i.e. stem side down.
Stem side down.
It's the only way to store a tomato on your counter. Please don't store it the other way, especially with an expensive tomato. So, yeah, here's my thing. And the other thing I took away from it is that, look, like I told you before, I buy these two tomatoes every year,
mm-hmm.
the German Stripes and the Aunt Ruby's. I know by color and feel exactly how I want them to be.
Yeah.
So typically I'll buy some that I'm going to eat today.
Right.
And I'll buy some I'm going to eat tomorrow. And then I'm going to buy some that I'm going to eat the day after that. And I leave them out on the counter and they come perfect exactly when I want them to, like an avocado does.
Like, yeah. Like you're buying, just like avocados, you're buying some ready to eat, some that have a day left in them, and some that need a couple days.
Right. And so I would never put those suckers in the fridge because I need them to get to their perfect spot.
Exactly.
But if you have something that's at its perfect spot, I guess I might have to concede that it degrades less in the fridge.
Wow.
That's what I found. I mean,
degrades less. It's less of an encrapponment than having it ripen past its perfect point. Interesting stuff.
You know I hate to do this, Dave.
Yes, we have to go. Thank you, yep. Daniel. Maybe you can come back
Thanks
for some fermented
me.
Shark.
Can I really?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, fermented shark next week, plus maybe a ketchup episode, cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.